I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly,
Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Machado addresses the media and talks about a free Venezuela and her meeting with Pope Leo. I'm Eric Rosales outside the Heritage Foundation. I'll have that story coming up.
Tensions grow even higher between the U.S. and Europe over Greenland. Now troops are on the move. We have the details. Plus, saintly influence 800 years later. We're in Rome with a special look at the Franciscan Jubilee year now underway. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of St. Marcellus, a 4th century pope. Our top story tonight.
We are definitely now into the first steps of a true transition to democracy that will have not only immense impact in the lives of all Venezuelans.
Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Machado talks about the future of her country and calls the current president of Venezuela a friend of U.S. adversaries like China and Russia. Her visit to D.C. comes less than 2 weeks after a U.S. military operation captured Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has the latest.
Good evening, Veronica. After Maria Machado, the Venezuelan opposition leader, met with President Trump yesterday and lawmakers up on Capitol Hill, she held a press conference today inside the Heritage Foundation, where she talked about a free Venezuela, one that the people could prosper.
I am very proud to be part of these generations of Venezuelans. Most of them have never known what it means to live in freedom, to be part of democratic society.
Machado says it's all about human dignity. So many Venezuelans have risked their lives because they shared a dream to live freely. A dream, she says, is now possible thanks to President Trump and his U.S. military.
The dirty work is being done by them, but then the result of a stable transition will be a proud Venezuela who is going to be the best ally the United States has ever had.
During her visit, she presented the president with her Nobel Peace Prize. Machado says it will be up to the Venezuelan people if she becomes president, but she will continue to fight to free the innocent prisoners under the Maduro regime. She also touched on her strong Catholic faith and meeting Pope Leo as one of the most moving days of her life.
I had a reassurance of the Holy Father that he knows very well what's going on in Venezuela. He knows what the Catholic Church is going through because of the persecution and pressure on our bishops and priests and nuns.
After Machado's visit with lawmakers on Thursday, I spoke with her chief of staff, who says Machado has a deep passion to bring change.
They're going to be a huge work together to recover the democracy for Venezuela. And I'm happy because I hear what she say, and she's, you know, with a furor in her mind.
Machado ended the conversation by talking about this is more than just about her. It's about the people of Venezuela, one that they can live without communism and tyranny and live in freedom. Outside the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Despite extreme weather conditions in Minnesota, demonstrations continue at the Whipple Federal Building and other locations after the ice-involved death of Renee Nicole Good on January 7th. Activists have used Good's death as justification for ongoing demonstrations and confrontations with law enforcement, but many of the interactions are escalating. The FBI announced multiple arrests today after protesters vandalized federal vehicles and stole operational documents. Meanwhile, a class action lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union accuses agents of systemic racial profiling and the illegal detention of U.S. citizens. With 2,500 federal agents now on the ground, state congressional leaders say they're holding emergency hearings in the Twin Cities. While the state is bracing for more protests this weekend, Good's former father-in-law is urging anti-ICE agitators to turn to prayer rather than rage following her death. For more, Elon Werman, a law professor at the University of Minnesota, joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So earlier this week, President Trump said he was considering the use of the Insurrection Act in Minnesota, but today he said he does not think he will need to use it. Can you explain to us what the Insurrection Act is?
Sure. So the Insurrection Act is somewhat unfortunately named because the act, although it allows the president to use the militia, which is today just the National Guard, when there's an insurrection, also allows for the National Guard to be used for other purposes, including when there's an obstruction or unlawful combinations or unlawful assemblages that are making law enforcement impracticable through the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. And that's what we arguably have here. At least that's what Trump is going to argue. And he would be on pretty solid legal grounds to say that. But it would be definitely a last resort.
And what justifications can be used to invoke the Insurrection Act?
So the standard is if through the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, enforcing the law is impracticable. And so the question here is using the judicial process impracticable? Well, you would need enough state and local officials to be able to arrest individuals who are interfering with ICE operations, and you would need them to be able to be processed in court. So to the extent that that's true, then the ordinary course of judicial proceedings should be intact. But if things get too violent or too riotous, it becomes very difficult to just go to a court and get an injunction telling people to disperse. You might not have enough resources to arrest the individuals who are interfering with operations. So again, it would have to be to the point where you can't just go to a court, and ordinary law enforcement and judicial proceedings are not feasible or plausible. And so, you know, the president will get some deference about his determination here. But as he's indicated, it really should be a last resort. And it's good to hear that it is to him a last resort, though he would have some legal grounds to invoke it, perhaps.
Elon Werman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bishop Kevin Kenney is the pastor of St. Olaf Catholic Church in Minneapolis. Bishop Kenney, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
You have asked your parishioners to join you in prayer this evening. Can you tell us more about the gathering?
We gathered at the site where Rene Good was shot and killed. So we gathered because of your presence in our city, peace and prayer. And we wanted to move our parishioners to a sense of action, of what we could do as a way of peace and solidarity in our city.
Now your church is located in downtown Minneapolis. What is the mood there?
Well, right now it's quiet, and we anticipate some action over the weekend in the way of rallies and protests. But it's a neighborhood surrounding downtown that are actively alive with immigration and the fear of people in their homes and not leaving and truly affecting the spirit of the city.
How important is it to remind people who are watching and, of course, down on the ground for prayer and calm?
It's very important that that's what we believe in as Christians, as Catholics, as faith-filled people. The prayer is asking God to intervene, that we may follow the way that God directs us, asking Our Lady to protect us and guide us as well, and recognizing that Jesus is always with us. And the way to peace and unity is truly through calm and not reacting to violence with violence.
Bishop Kenney, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
A U.S. delegation met today with leaders of Denmark and Greenland over President Trump's recent push to acquire the island territory. The 11-member delegation was led by Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. They met this morning in Copenhagen. After the meeting, Senator Coons told reporters that lawmakers will try to, quote, lower the temperature upon returning home. Meanwhile, in Greenland itself, military personnel arrived from France and Germany ahead of today's meeting. They are preparing for exercises along with Denmark in an effort to show that security there is not under threat. An uneasy calm has returned to Tehran, but the rhetoric is intensifying. Today, a senior hardline cleric demanded the death penalty for detained demonstrators, calling them soldiers for President Trump and Israel. The internet remains down as the death toll has risen to nearly 2,800 people. While the streets appear normal, thousands remain in custody following 2 weeks of anti-government protests. President Trump has since signaled that he's held off on military strikes on Iran aimed at the nationwide protests after claiming that the country had canceled executions for hundreds of Iranians. This is what Reza Pahlavi, son of Iran's last Shah, said today here in Washington, D.C.
The Islamic Republic is close to collapse. Ali Khamenei and his thugs know this. That's why they are lashing out like a wounded animal, desperate to cling to power. The people have not retreated. Their determination has made one thing clear. They are not merely rejecting this regime. They are demanding a credible new path forward.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon has ordered the USS Abraham Lincoln and its carrier strike group to move from the South China Sea to the Middle East. The strategic shift comes as tensions between the Trump administration and Iran continue. The deployment is expected to take about a week. It aims to fill a rare gap in U.S. naval presence in the region and provide President Trump with offensive military options following weeks of widespread protests across Iran. Mossad Director David Barnea arrived in the U.S. today for urgent consultations on the situation in Iran. He is expected to meet with White House envoy Steve Witkoff as the Trump administration weighs its next move. Earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a telephone conversation to discuss the current situation in Iran and other issues across the Middle East. According to the Kremlin, Putin reiterated Russia's readiness to provide mediation efforts. The statement from the Kremlin also noted that Putin favored intensifying political and diplomatic steps to ensure regional security. Canada and China are easing long-standing trade tensions. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney made the announcement earlier today after 2 days of meetings with Chinese leaders.
And so I'm pleased today to announce that Canada and China have reached a preliminary but landmark trade agreement to remove trade barriers and reduce tariffs. By March the 1st, Canada expects that China will lower tariffs on Canadian canola seed to a combined rate of approximately 15%. Canada has agreed to allow up to 49,000 Chinese electric vehicles into the Canadian market, with the most favored nation tariff rate of 6.1%.
It's the first time a Canadian prime minister has visited China since 2017. The partnership comes after relations between Canada and the U.S. soured in the face of tariffs implemented by President Trump. It marks a significant change in the relationship between Canada and China and comes as the Trump administration wants to reduce China's presence in the Western Hemisphere. President Trump and administration officials addressed the many health care challenges facing rural America, including a shortage of health care professionals and specialists, as well as difficulty accessing high-quality care. Rural states are now sharing billions of dollars to make improvements, but the hurdles remain high. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Veronica, it's called the Rural Health Transformation Program, aimed at millions of Americans living in rural areas trying to access quality health care without having to drive for miles and miles.
Surrounded by top health officials, cabinet members, and physicians from rural America, President Donald Trump delivers remarks in the East Room.
As part of the Great Big Beautiful Bill, we're increased and we have increased funding for the health care by an unprecedented $50 billion. That's rural health care. Nobody thought that was going to happen, and we got it done.
He also told the many physicians, nurses, and pharmacists in the audience.
So we have rural health care for those that were trying to make a case that we weren't taking care of the rural community. I'm all about the rural community.
Dr. Mehmet Oz, who runs the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, says there are 60 million rural Americans. He laid out the serious health problems they face every day.
These folks do not have access to the same care that's available in urban and suburban America. Their life expectancy, if they're in a vulnerable situation, is 9 years shorter. Because your zip code actually is your destiny. It determines how long you're going to live, and we can make a dent in this.
The president also discussed his new Great Health Care Plan, a plan he says mandates unprecedented accountability and transparency from insurance companies and all health care providers.
We want transparency. You're not allowed to ask a doctor how much is it going to cost. You're going to have your heart ripped out, and you're not allowed to negotiate. This is a giant scam.
Now, separately tonight, After that event in the East Room with the president, I was able to ask President Trump a question as he walked towards Marine One on the South Lawn.
Mr. President, the March for Life, sir, the March for Life is next week. And some pro-lifers are worried about your support for the Hyde Amendment. What do you tell them?
Well, you know what I tell them? You're going to hear about it because I just taped a beautiful piece for them, and they're going to play it. And those are great people. I want to tell you, they're great people.
Just recently, President Trump told Republican lawmakers they have to be flexible on Hyde, and that raised alarms among pro-life advocates and lawmakers. And we're also learning tonight, Vice President J.D. Vance will join the March for Life rally on the National Mall taking place next week. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. From pitch to pew, a Catholic quarterback leads his team to the National College Football Championships. His school pastor tells us about the journey. And a new report reveals the impact of the National Eucharistic Revival. The outcomes may inspire you. The National College Football Championships are just around the corner with a historic match between the University of Miami and Indiana. It's even being called the most unexpected national title game. Indiana's quarterback Fernando Mendoza is a faithful Catholic and last year's winner of the Heisman Trophy. Known to give glory to God after games, Mendoza took the team to the finals, marking the first time Indiana has made it to the national championships. I recently had the chance to speak with the pastor of the Newman Center there, who supports the players on and off the field. Joining me now to tell us about the upcoming college football championship is Father Patrick Hyde, pastor at the St. Paul Catholic Center, which serves Indiana University. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've been attending the games. What has it been like watching your team, the Indiana Hoosiers, make it to the National College Football Championship?
Well, Veronica, it's been an incredible ride this year, in particular the last 2 years since Kurt Cignetti became our head coach. From where we were 2 years ago, where the stands are practically empty, to now playing for the national championship is kind of a surreal experience for all of us long-suffering Hoosier fans. But it's been a real blessing, especially this year, to get to know some of our Catholic players on the team, including our quarterback and Heisman Trophy winner, Fernando Mendoza, and others, and to see their not only their success, but also their courageous and zealous sharing of their Catholic faith.
It's been special to see where, you know, I could have gone to now where I've gone. And I really think it's really been God's plan.
Now, you have been the pastor for the Indiana Catholic community for 10 years, seeing success not just on the football field, but also in the pews as well. What has that journey been like?
Well, I started at St. Paul's in 2016. I was right out of the seminary. I'd just been ordained a priest, and I was asked to help run campus ministry. And at that time, I knew every single student who was in leadership. We only had about a dozen or so. And on a campus of 40,000+ students at the time, and to see us go from about a dozen student leaders and about 50 students in Bible studies to almost 120+ students in formation with our focus missionaries and 500 more students attending Bible study. And then our mass attendance has gone from 400 to 500 a weekend to more than 1,200. It's been a wonderful experience of growth. And I'm hearing that not only from my own experience, but from pastors all over the country at Newman Centers. We're seeing a tremendous growth in interest and a desire for the Catholic Christian faith. So many are setting records for the number of students, including St. Paul Catholic Center at Indiana University, of the number of young people who are coming to us and exploring Catholicism and becoming Catholic.
Yes, we continue to track these trends of younger generations returning to the faith or joining the faith, which is fantastic. Now, looking ahead, how are you and the Hoosier Catholics preparing for the championship? And do you think we'll see a win?
Well, in all things, we try to give glory to God and to prepare as best we can. One of the things I like to say about our Hoosiers this year is that they try to maximize and get the most out of their gifts and talents. And that requires discipline. It requires execution. And it's an opportunity also for all of us to recognize that with the gifts and talents we have, we can give glory to God and be excellent. We're hoping, of course, for a win, but we give thanks to God for whatever comes our way. And I pray in particular, and our community prays, for the safety and the well-being and for the excellence of all of our players.
a great sentiment heading into the big game. Father Patrick High, thank you so much.
Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. You too. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops recently published the National Eucharistic Revival Impact Report, and the numbers are profound. The findings included a greater participation in the Eucharist adoration, confession, and increased reverence at Mass. Bishop Andrew Cozens, chairman of the National Eucharistic Congress, shared his thoughts on the outcomes.
I was extremely heartened by what has been found in our impact study that we did. And, you know, I had a sense that the revival had a big impact on people and especially on our church. But it was great to see that confirmed by the data and to see some of the actual statistics. I think the thing that most stood out to me is that we accomplished our goal. Our goal was really to bring about a missionary conversion of Catholics, right? We wanted Catholics to come together and to experience a more deeply a profound love for Jesus in the Eucharist, and then from that to be sent out on mission.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, the pardon of Assisi, what it is and how the saint behind it changed the life of the church. Years ago, St. Francis of Assisi, a poor friar, changed the life of the church. To honor him, Pope Leo has proclaimed a special Jubilee year. The faithful are invited to open their hearts to God's forgiving love to experience a deeper conversion of life. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Settegrin has more.
When Christ and Our Lady appeared to St. Francis one night in 1216, they asked him what he desired for the salvation of souls. The Franciscan friar answered simply that whoever came to visit the Porciuncula Chapel would be granted complete forgiveness of their sins. Pope Honorius III later approved this indulgence, which became known as the Pardon of Assisi. Now, in 2026, Pope Leo has proclaimed a special year of St. Francis to commemorate the 800th anniversary of the saint's death and to honor his desire for all to obtain God's mercy.
800 years later, Pope Leo, in his wisdom and graciousness, has said, yep, we're going to honor the intention of St. Francis to say plenary indulgence for all who come to any Franciscan church, not only for Franciscan priests and religious, for all priests and religious and members of consecrated life and societies of apostolic life, for all faithful, even for those who are sick, have to be at home or in hospital, those who are bedridden, who can't come to the church, but have that spiritual desire to unite themselves with this Franciscan Jubilee.
Among the notable events taking place in Assisi during the year will be the first extended public display of St. Francis's mortal remains between February 22nd and March 22nd. So far, some 250,000 pilgrims have registered for the veneration of the relics, a testament, the Basilica said, to the universality of the message of the Saint of Assisi and the timeless appeal of his figure.
It's a reminder that St. Francis isn't someone, a legendary name like Robin Hood or Friar Tuck. St. Francis was real, he was one of us. And the bones are a reminder that all that we have in life is passing, and that faith, hope, and love are the things that are the realities that remain forever.
During his most recent visit to Assisi, Pope Leo recalled that St. Francis's witness is especially important at a time when the world is searching for signs of hope. In the decree announcing the Jubilee year, he also prayed that every Christian, following the example of the Saint of Assisi, may himself become a model of holiness of life and a constant witness of peace in a world marked by division and uncertainty. Brother John says that St. Francis lived in a world with its own division and uncertainties, but through it all, he always looked to Christ.
And St. Francis said, let us believe in each other, let us believe that we can build a world of peace, of justice, of love, and of harmony through charity and through goodwill. I think he'd have been delighted to know that with this Jubilee year, the world is being invited to recognize that there is mercy in this world, that we can grow in charity, that we can pray and hope and work towards harmony and peace.
In Rome, Benedictia de Grian for EWTN News Nightly.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.